Welcome to this special edition of STP Radio, the STP Con Spring 2015 Keynote Series. Take some time and learn how Joseph Hours, National Quality Assurance and Testing Service Lead at Centric Consulting, applies behavioral psychological studies in his keynote, Thinking Fast and Slow, for Testers' Everyday Life, recorded on April 2nd, 2015.
All right, guys, welcome back. Hope you had a great night last night. And we got a really good day today. It's going to be our first time that we're doing a full day on our last day of the conference. So we're really excited about what we've got. We've got some extended sessions, and it's going to be really good. With that said, our keynote speaker today is Joseph Hours. He's the National QA and Testing Lead for Centric Consulting. He's been part of our STP program for many years, and he sits on the national board for Prescalis, which is a nonprofit organization out of New York. He's the chair of the Columbus Advisory Council for Prescalis. He's also the chair of the board for QA or the Highway, which is a regional conference in Columbus, Ohio. So without further ado, let's welcome, give a big hand for Joseph Hours.
Thanks, Mike. Wow, those lights are bright. How are you guys doing this morning? Good? You guys have a lot of fun the past couple of days? Yeah? How many people were here for the workshops? Weren't those awesome this year? Make sure you put that in your eval forward so that people come back for those, so they bring them back and stuff. So, apologize. Got somebody down here taking pictures. Thanks. It's like paparazzi. So, one of the things I want to kind of talk about today is really the community of software testing. And some of the stuff we're going to talk about with the presentation is not the same as what I'm going to talk about right now. But this is really, really a great community. I've met, every time I come here, I meet new people. I met Kate this time, Daniel, Chris, Dave. Some of these folks I've crossed paths with online. You know, Mr. Larson, paparazzi down here. And so this is really a great opportunity for us to see the people that we encounter online, but also just develop new friendships with folks who are in this community, and we're all in this together. And so this is really great. I've got a couple of lifelong friends that I see at the conference every year, Raj and Carlene. They're really great people. So this is a great opportunity. If you guys have come here with a large group, and I know Quicken is really represented today, make sure that you guys go out and meet some other folks. Whoop, whoop, there you go. Make sure you guys go out and meet some other folks and develop those friendships. Do that knowledge share, not just here while you're at the conference, but continue on. And I forgot Daniel from Iowa. I'm sorry, Brandon, sorry. You know, it's funny story. So he has a really great, if you guys should talk to him. He has a really great kind of philosophy on mindset and people who are successful versus people who aren't. And you should talk to him. He kind of threw me way off guard because he came up to me and he's wearing flip-flops, and I'm not trying to call you out. He's wearing flip-flops. I'm like, yeah, this guy's from California. I'm like, where are you from? Iowa. Really? So, great people, you know, hope to strike up a long-term friendship with you, and this is really a great conference for that. This is my contact information. Mike introduced me pretty well, so other than being in the industry for almost half my life, it's about all I'll reveal about my age. You guys can read about me online, so we don't really need to go into that. Unfortunately, if you guys have ever done speaking engagements, you know that this particular graphic is true. I only have about 10, maybe 15 minutes to grab your attention, and then it wanes. In fact, I can already see people right behind the keyboards and on their phones and doing stuff. So I'm going to do something that a lot of other people don't do. I'm going to give you all of the endpoints at the beginning. So here we go. These are the best times of day to change somebody's mind, schedule meetings, and to be creative. Great stuff to know. We'll dig into these here in a little bit. You should follow the 90-30-4-5 rule, which is a rule I made up. I'm going to claim ownership of it, but we're going to have a lot of fun with it. You should learn to leverage silence, and you should never discourage people. All right. So that's the end. So if you want to leave, you can do so. Perfect, right? All right, so we might do some bonus material if people haven't done this before. If too many people are aware of this, I won't bore everybody with it. Does anybody remember me doing this presentation? Some of you have seen a variation of this before. Oh, good, then we can do this. Here's what I want everybody to do, because we're going to have some fun. Everyone get a piece of paper and a writing utensil. Pen, pencil, pen prick in your finger with blood, whatever you desire. We're going to have some fun. You guys didn't know there were going to be exercises for a keynote, did you? Got to get you amped up for the day. Come on, you guys can do it. Oh, you're ready. Good. Perfect. Yeah, you're good. Nice. Nice. There will be plenty. Uh-oh. I'm in trouble. Beware of people with access to social media. All right. Everybody ready? Raise your hand real quick just so I can see how we're doing in the room. All right. We got enough people ready. The rest of you follow on. First exercise that we're going to do. Very, very simple. I want you to write the alphabet down. We're going to do this for roughly 8 seconds. A, B, C, D, E, F. As far as you can get in 8 seconds, and I will tell you when to start. You have to wait. This is not Simon Says. This is when Joe says, okay? So here we go. On your mark. Get set. Go. Keep writing. Keep going. All right, time's up. Fast 8 seconds, right? Anybody get to M? How about S? Yeah, there's a dramatic drop-off between M and S. Some people get further. I've had people get disease. I've got people starting over. How far did you get?
U.
That's really good. All right, now here's what I want you to do. Right beneath that, we're going to do something similar, except this time I want you to write numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, as far as you can go. When I tell you to start, and then we're going to go. Okay. So on your mark, get set, go. Time's up. 15, 20. Every time I can call it 15 and 20. So those are for some pretty simple tasks. You got 30, but you typed. Somebody over here is typing like 120 characters a minute here, or a second. There you go. Very, very, very creative. All right. So now I want you to flip your piece of paper over. Go to a new document on your computer if you're doing it electronically. This is the final part of the exercise. All right. So now it gets a little complicated. But I'm sure you guys can handle it because you're in the testing community and we only have great, smart people in the community. So now I want you to alternate. A1, B2, C3, D4. All right, you guys understand? So when I tell you to go, we'll start. On your mark, get set, go. Time's up. So, here's the question. Who wrote as many characters as either one of the first two exercises? So in other words, E5 would be like 10 characters. Who did that? You got to E5, right?
I got to H.
That's really, really good. Was that harder than the first two exercises? Yeah. Does anybody know why that is? Because it's the morning. Because the coffee has not kicked in. Well, it's not the morning. Well, it is the morning. You're right. You're absolutely right. Thank you. The morning is not the cause of why that exercise is hard. However, it could be a contributing factor. So as could be hangovers, illnesses, general disinterest, right? So what really makes that exercise really a challenge is there's a concept called context switching. And so when your brain has to switch from doing one thing to another, there's a time basically where it has to spin its resources down and spin it back up on the other thing. That's very, very fast because you were all able to do something, right? But there's a productivity hit when you have to do this context switching. And so this is one of the things they talk about in Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. and this is the bonus material here, but I really kind of pointed out because it really talks about the myth of multitasking. Have people heard of that phrase, the myth of multitasking? So this is a great example that you can take back to your workplace, right? It's a simple 8-second, easy instructions, right? It's not like a knock-knock joke that you have to try and remember. This is actually easy to remember. You can take this back to your workplace, and you can talk to your teams about multitasking and how that actually impacts productivity. In fact, researchers have found that you could, depending on the circumstance and depending on lots of factors, you could lose as much as 40% of your productivity by doing this context switching. So if you're working on multiple projects at the same time, every time you move from one task on one to another task on another, you're going to take a productivity hit. You're not going to be as productive if you separated your duties throughout your day. So give that some thought and how you can take that back to your environment and say, you know what, I'm only going to do this project in the morning or maybe this one in the afternoon. And I realize not everybody has that kind of control over their schedule, their day, but something to consider, and this is a great example for that. The other thing, and what's the really fun part about this is a typical IQ chart, right? And I got this fancy laser, thanks Rick for this. But most of us are probably in this upper range, at least 100 IQ, I hope and I believe, because we're in this community, right? But we work with people who aren't. But what's really interesting about this, what's really interesting about IQ and productivity switching is your IQ is variable. There's some elasticity in your IQ. You can take an IQ test many, many times and get some different scores and they will vary. So what some researchers did is they had folks take a standard IQ test and they had a control group. So they did this in a scientific way. They then had another group of people take an IQ test, but they interrupted the IQ test by having them answer emails. Now, these emails were simply to respond to somebody saying hello. It wasn't mentally taxing. It wasn't all that distracting in terms of they didn't have to put any thought into responding to the email. They were told what to respond with and just the fact that they were interrupting the test and going over. And what the researchers found is that people's IQ as a score in the group dropped by about 10 points simply by checking email. And so if you can see up here, some folks can't afford to lose 10 IQ points, right? So I like to tell people that email makes you dumb. So those of you checking email right now, your IQ is 10 points lower than where it should be, right? So this is an important thing to learn, you know, learn about distractions in the workplace and how it can affect your productivity. But it's not just your productivity, your ability to get things done. It's also about your brain wattage, right? You can dim your own light bulb by unnecessary distractions in your workday. So that's just something to consider, something that you can take back and leverage. All right, so that's the bonus material. Are you guys ready to get to the main content? Was that fun? Was that good bonus material? Yeah? All right, so what's our number one challenge in the workplace today? You may have an idea. Emails. Distractions, right? That's interruptions, that's good. People? Is that what somebody said? Was that you, Kate? I can't see because of the lights here. Yeah.
Open office plan.
That's really interesting. We could talk about that. You know, I love this stage up here because every time I walk, it creaks. It's like I'm in an old house. Can you guys hear it out there?
Yes.
Sorry.
Okay.
Maybe I should stand back here, right? So I would contend that our number one challenge today is actually time. It doesn't matter where I walk, it creaks. Everything that we do is driven by time. How many people are on Agile teams? What's the mantra about Agile teams and time? Time is fixed, scope is not, but it's still time-driven, right? Waterfall processes, date-driven. Everything that you do tends to be time-driven. Tasks have a deadline. There's an expectation of when they will be complete. And when you don't meet it, you know, people come and yell at you or ask questions, right? So I would contend that time is our number one challenge. If we had infinite time, there's a lot we could do, isn't there? Those of you who want to automate 100% of everything, if you had infinite time, you could do it. Those of you who want to test 100% of everything, if you had infinite time, you could probably do it. But we don't. Time is probably the number one limiting constraint that we have in our job today. So this presentation is going to be about optimizing your time and getting most out of people while you have them in your presence. So that's going to be the two kind of key areas that we're going to talk about today. So we're going to start with optimizing your time, or optimizing your day. And we're going to start by figuring out when the best time of day to change somebody's mind is. Does anybody realize that there's a best time of day to engage somebody to get them to change their opinion? One person. Awesome. Two people. Please, feel free to raise your hand. I'm not going to call you out, Kate. No, I'm just kidding. There's the best time of day to be creative. And of course, there's actually optimal times for scheduling meetings. I'm sure everybody kind of knew that there's an optimal time for scheduling meetings, but you might not know what time that is. So we're going to talk about some of that. So we're going to drill into each of these. So changing somebody's mind. All right, so we're going to do another exercise here because I need to do it to illustrate a point. And I'm going to split the room in half. So this will be, let's have some fun. This will be the first group. I'm going to have you guys go first. So these two rows of tables, or columns, depending on your orientation room. And then these two rows or columns are going to be on the second part of the exercise. So the first part of the exercise, has anybody played like those luminosity, brain games type things? So this is a very simple one. This is the color matching one. So I'm going to show some words on the screen, and they're going to be colors. But those words themselves are going to be in a color. So example, I've got yellow up there, but it's actually colored blue. What I want you to say is the color of the word, not the color word that's spelled. So when you see yellow, you're not going to say yellow, you're going to say blue. Simple enough? So I'm going to do this in two groups, have you guys go first, right? This is going to be fun, I promise. All right, so are you guys ready over here? I'll help you get started. And we're going to go left to right, top to bottom. Make sense? All right, you guys ready? So we have red, green, blue, yellow, pink. Awesome. I have my own cult. They're chanting for me. Yo, where's the Kool-Aid? I think it's right out there. You guys have been drinking it all morning, didn't know it. All right. So you guys, we're going to do the same thing. This is going to be a little harder, but we're going to do it. All right. Same concept. It's a different set of words. All right. Are you guys ready? All right. Green, yellow, white, pink, orange, blue, red. Perfect. Well, almost perfect. A lot slower, right? It almost, I've actually done this before, and the room almost grinds to a halt. It's like the cassette player with dying batteries. They're like red, blue. It's really funny. So you guys weren't quite that bad. So you guys are on top of it. Part of that is because it is the morning, and you guys have just eaten. And that's actually what we're going to talk about here. And so the next thing we're going to do, I'm going to ask you guys a question, engage your own personal interest and effort that you would expend to solve this problem. We're not actually going to solve it. Right? It's a little brain teaser, and we'll get to why we're not going to solve it because it takes too long. But if I had 12 identical looking marbles, except one of them was weighted either lighter or heavier than the other 11, and I had a scale, could you figure out which one weighed more or less in three weightings or less, and whether or not it was actually lighter or heavier than the others?
Yes.
You guys know, so you know there is a solution to this, right? Mm-hmm. Did you guys watch there was a TV sitcom with this? Similar example? All right. So, are you guys trying to solve this in your mind, by the way? Trying to figure it out? Want to expend some effort? What about you guys? You guys have really any desire to try and solve it? No. Some? Not as much. So this group over here actually is a little more enthusiastic about trying to solve it, and this group is not. And there's actually a reason for that, and it's the previous two exercises we did that triggered that effect in people. And it's a concept called ego depletion. Has anybody heard of ego depletion? I'm happily married. Stop hitting on me, please. All right, so there is an answer. If you get the slide deck, you can go see what it is. But this is really interesting. And I put this little experiment together because what actually triggered it was a study done by some judges. It's the parole study. I don't know if anybody has heard of that before. Some folks. So the reason that ego depletion is important in our environment and how it affects, you know, persuading people is going to be revealed through this study. So in this study, they found that these parole judges, and they're hearing criminal cases, right? These folks have been convicted, tried, and are serving some time. They're just coming up for parole. They spend an average of about 6 minutes on their parole cases to figure out whether or not the person should be granted parole or not. The default position always is denial of parole, right? You've been convicted of a crime, you should serve that time. Most people don't get parole, right? That's just the nature of the criminal justice system, if you will. And so, as a result, the average parolee only has about a 1 in 3 chance of being granted parole. It's not necessarily surprising, is it? Nobody's really surprised by that, are they? What if I told you that based on the time of day that your parole case is heard, you could increase your odds to 2 in 3 of getting parole? Would that be surprising? Well, that's actually what they found. At certain times of day, the parole rate would double to about 65%. And that's pretty significant because all other things being equal, they're hearing a variety of criminal cases. They, you know, have the facts in front of them, right? There's nothing significant about the inmates who are going up for parole, per se. And they ran the study for an extended period of time, so it's not just a one-day observation. But what they did is they plotted the percentage of parole grants based on the time of day. And there are some interesting things here. So it tends to peak, and then it slowly decays. And then it peaks again, and it slowly decays. Does anybody have an idea of why they might have peaked? Somebody, a couple people in the way in the back, because you guys know this. Go ahead.
Blood sugar.
Food.
Lunch.
Absolutely right. Meal breaks. Meal breaks was the key triggering factor that caused people to change their default position, if you will. So when you're trying to talk to somebody about changing their opinion about a topic, the worst time to talk to them is effectively when they're hungry. Their blood glucose levels are lower than normal. They're probably fatigued from focusing on other activities throughout the day. So that's the worst time to engage somebody if you need them to change their mind. Right? But if you want to have the best chance of getting them to change their mind, get them right after they've had a meal. And you have roughly about 90 minutes window to take advantage of that. And that's kind of denoted by those declines. Now, there are some other breaks in here, right? There's a spike, there's a drop, there's some spikes, but the general trend is a downward trend. And so we'll talk about some of this a little later because it'll go into one of the other sections. But simply by eating and having your case heard shortly after somebody has eaten, you doubled your chances of being granted parole, everything else being equal. So when you're in your work environment and you've got a boss and you're like, you know what, I really think we should adopt some agile principles, or maybe we should adopt some, you know, automation to make our lives a little easier. I'm sorry? Feed them first, right? So here's what's interesting. How many people are in sales here? Because I know we got some vendors, some folks. What really stinks about the acknowledgement of this study is because blood glucose doesn't start when you take the first bite. You have like a 45-minute lag between the time you eat and your blood glucose goes, you know, back up in your brain. When you take people out for lunch, you're getting them when they're most resistant to hearing your message. You're feeding them and ending the conversation before they're the most receptive for hearing your message. So think about that when you're scheduling sales meetings. But the same is true, you know, of your boss. If you take your boss out to lunch and you're trying to get them to change their mind, you're like, hey, lunch would be a nice way to do that. You're doing yourself kind of a disservice here. Maybe you go to lunch and it's purely social, and then right after lunch, right, at the end of lunch, wait like half an hour or so, then have that meeting to get them to change their mind. So what this means for you guys is if you need somebody to change their mind, have the meeting early in the morning, have the discussion then, 8, 9:30, right after lunch, starting at, you know, 12 to 1 for roughly 90 minutes, depending on that person's schedule, you will have a better chance of changing their mind. So how many people find that useful? Perfect. Put that on your eval. All right. So what about being creative? People realize there's the best time of day for being creative? Early mornings? Possibly. We'll get into that. Nights? You're both right and wrong. Congratulations. No. So there's a study done by Albion College and Michigan State University. Is anybody familiar with either one of these institutions? Whoop, whoop, Michigan State, right? Big Ten represent. Buckeyes still took the championship, sorry. With the third string quarterback. All right, enough about that. yeah, okay, I have to give it to you. Big Ten has strong representation this year, just not from Ohio. Sad to say, but that's okay. I support Big Ten, right? As long as, if it's not Ohio State, it should at least be the Big Ten, so hopefully, cross our fingers. Anyways, so these guys did a study on creativity, and what was really interesting about it is they did identify that there's kind of a best time of day for folks to be creative. There's a lot of stuff that went into the study, and we'll get into a whole lot of the details. But what they found is when you are clear-headed, when you are most refreshed, you have the best ability to focus, which happens to absolutely be the worst time to be creative. So it took me a while to kind of figure this out. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense, especially with what I know about ego depletion, right? Why would that particular statement be true? And so what I found is there's a difference between critical thinking that is really highly dependent on ego depletion and creative thinking, which requires you to be able to view things from a different perspective. And so we are best able to view things from a different perspective when we are a little foggy. And I'm not saying that we are alcohol-induced fog, however, some people may claim that, right? I don't see Mark here. Is Mark? Oh. Oh. He's being creative right now, right? Love Mark, not picking on him too much. Hashtag I'm in trouble. So when you are foggy brained, right, when you are more easily distracted, you actually can engage some critical, some creative thought processes that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. And this is because when you are fully focused, you tend to make assumptions and you tend to latch on to those assumptions and drive with them from a creative perspective. And you don't always see things from an opposite point of view or a different point of view. So it's all about perspective. And it's still a little confusing, right? Because when you say that, you're like, well, you just said that I can get people to change their mind right after they eat when they are more able to focus. And this comes back to understanding the difference in thought processes that, unfortunately, we don't have time to go into, that's between critical thinking and creative thinking. Creative thinking is about allowing lots of different inputs to permeate your thoughts and be willing to at least acknowledge their existence, whether or not you actually are willing to follow them. And that's different. The other thing is when you're being creative, you're not necessarily changing your default belief system, but when you're doing critical thinking and you're trying to convince others, when they have to do some critical thinking to change their default belief systems, you need to take advantage of their ego being fully powered up. You were going to ask a question. There could be some of that. I'd have to look into it. Possibly. Except for people who are left-handed, does that mean it's opposite? Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff that you could look into this. But so what this really means for us is depending on whether or not you're a night owl or a day person, go ahead. Michael wants to chime in, so we're going to make this. I'm Phil Donovan. Go ahead. Yep. You're right. those are your critical thinking times versus your creative. And again, the creative process is how do I want to say this in layman's terms? So this is one of those things I wasn't prepared to use the definition of creativity without using the word create. So now you guys are seeing the introverted side of me, like shrivel up inside going, oh crap, what do I say next? So if you guys have never spoke before, this is one of those moments that you kind of hate as a speaker. But the creative process is about assimilating lots of different things and being open to new ways of viewing things or approaching things. And again, that doesn't mean that you're changing your default belief system. It doesn't mean, sorry, Rick, I'm throwing the Molotov cocktail. This isn't about a context-driven tester saying, I believe in certification now, or a certification person believing, I don't believe in certification, I don't believe in context-driven, right? That's part of your belief system. And so it's not that you are changing that. Is that offensive? Is that what you said? So your creative processes aren't going to change your belief system, but your critical thinking process could. And so that's one of the key differences. So we're going to move on here. If you are a night owl or a day person, these times of day changes for you, as Michael sort of pointed out. Your different circadian rhythms have lots of different influences over what's going on. But the one phrase that I like to, before we move on to what time of day works best for you, is Mark Twain's quote here, right? Man was made at the end of the week when God was tired, right? Give that some thought. Love Mark Twain. So if you are a night owl, right, your best time to be creative might be 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, right, depending on when the end of your sort of day is. If you're a morning person, that might be earlier in the day, and that might be like a 6 or 7 p.m., right? That's probably your best time to be creative. If you're looking to do something new, to kind of be creative, that would be the best time. If you have to focus to accomplish a task, these are not the best times because you're actually really, really fatigued. There's a whole concept of decision fatigue and that type of stuff that goes into this. All right. So what about meetings here? So this is not based on any cognitive science. This is actually based on some research from all of these different groups. Has anybody heard of some of these before, other than like Forbes and Washington Post, you know, HubSpot, customer.io? They have lots of great data. And so when we talk about meetings here, I'm not going to talk about the effectiveness of the meeting itself because there are too many variables. We're going to talk about a good scheduled meeting being sending a meeting invite out, having it accepted, and then having people attend. So we can't really control how well a meeting goes because that's dependent really on the participants. But if you need to schedule a meeting, you want people to accept an invite and you want to attend, there's actually some best times of days and some best days of weeks for that. And so does anybody have, I was going to ask this question, but apparently I clicked too fast. So these are the best time of days to do meetings. You have a bump around 10 a.m. and you have a bigger bump between the 2 and sort of 4 p.m. time zone. Does that make sense? Does everyone like, if I want to schedule a meeting, I usually do it in the afternoon because most people are open. Sometimes at 10 o'clock. 8, 9 o'clock meetings are almost always booked. Lunches are always bad. Right? So that's not necessarily, you know, a surprise, is it? What about days of week? Does anybody have an idea on which days of the week are better for scheduling and having meetings? Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Absolutely. With Tuesday being the best. So again, this is a lot of data that's compiled by these folks, but what does this really mean for us? If you want people to attend, shoot for Tuesday, preferably Tuesday afternoon or morning as a backup. However, and this is really important, if you're in an organization where silence or absence is consent to whatever the meeting room agrees to, go ahead and schedule your meeting for Monday and Friday, Monday morning or Friday afternoon. I'll leave the intent up to you guys, right? You can be malicious or not, right? So again, you guys are all good guys. I trust you to use this information wisely. All right. So let's talk about getting the most out of people during your day. And so we're going to talk about the 90-30-4-5 rule, which is a rule I made up. Rick, how am I doing on time? Good? Perfect. We're also going to talk about silence. And we're also going to talk about encouragement in the workplace, and we're going to attempt to do some exercise with it. But the 90-30-4-5 rule, if you remember back to this chart here, so not only do we have a general decline between meals, we also have some ups and downs and peaks throughout the day. And so when I did some more research into this, there's kind of a reason why, and part of it is a little bit of circadian rhythm stuff. But what you really get if you go back to that chart and blow it out on a kind of hour by hour basis, you get about 90 minutes of productivity. And then if you take a 30 minute break, right, you tend to reset your productivity. So your mind is like a muscle, right? I know everybody hates that analogy and hates, you know, the whole thing of working out. So I'm not talking about training your mind to run a marathon, but what we are talking about is most people really don't have the ability to focus intensely for longer than 90 minutes without needing some sort of break. Their productivity declines, their accuracy declines, everything just kind of goes to hell in a handbasket, if you will. So taking that information is like, well, how can I use that in the workplace? Well, I could probably chunk up my day into 2-hour blocks. And if I need to do some critical thinking, I can focus on it for 90 minutes. And then I could work on something that is a little less taxing for 30 minutes to recover. You know what might be good in that 30 minutes?
Email.
Thank you. Pulling it all together. So this is one thing that I've started to do. In fact, I put this presentation together kind of in that fashion. I'm like, well, let me focus on it for 90 minutes, and I'll go do something else. And then I'll either come back or I'll work on another hard task. And I work in consulting, so you guys know what that's like, right? You have lots of things to do. But it's actually not that difficult to do, to chunk your day into 2-hour blocks and spend 90 minutes doing some intense concentration and followed by 30 minutes of less taxing type stuff. And it makes a difference. It makes it seem like you get more stuff done, right? Because you are being more productive, but it also provides some structure that makes it seem like you're also getting more stuff done because you usually have a task list. You start the day and say, these are my 4 big things. This is my 8-hour day. Here's my 2-hour blocks for each. Provides that structure that makes it feel like you're accomplishing something. And so I found this really, really useful for me. So that was the start of my 90-30 portion of the rule. So let's go into the 4-5 portion. And so I've got this question up here. Some of you may know this. But who was the person who lobbied Congress to reduce and limit the work week to a 40-hour work week? How many people saw the presentation and downloaded it before today? Henry Ford. And that's interesting. And I know everybody hates manufacturing analogies in the testing community. But this one isn't manufacturing necessarily based, but about productivity. So it's really interesting. Because Ford did this thing called a $5 day revolution. Has anybody heard of this before? So this is just going to be the highlights of it and not some of the more nefarious sides of it. All right, so Ford, prior to 1914, Ford had some major problems. They had low production quality. They had they assembled a lot of their cars. They came back. They needed to be reworked. They had low morale and extremely high turnover. They averaged cycling through about 55,000 people to maintain a 13,000 FTE equivalent prior to the $5 day revolution. So imagine that. For every person you've hired, you've got to hire 4 people to get a full, really work year sort of out of that person. And while they're doing this, they were only producing about 80,000 cars a year. Not insignificant, but having to cycle through 4 people to get the effort of 1 throughout a year, that's a major headache, right? There's training, there's, you know, we call it onboarding in the IT community, right? There's onboarding, there's training, right? And then they're not fully productive. Right? Because they're still coming up to speed. Nobody starts day one being proficient at getting something done. Right? Even if you're an expert in the field, right, there's usually some cultural adaptation that takes place when dealing, you know, with a new environment that can reduce your productivity, feeling people out, trying to understand what you can and can't say. Right? So Ford had some major problems and he's like, I need to solve this. So what Ford did is he ran about a dozen studies on productivity, morale, all kinds of stuff, and you can read about them online. Really, really interesting stuff. Well, ultimately, what he came up with is he needed to shorten the workday by an hour, and that was the basis of limiting Congress to a 40-hour work week and supporting that proposal. And he increased pay from $2.25 a day to $5 a day. Now, again, we're talking 1914, right? But he doubled their pay, and he shortened their workday. What do you think everybody else in the industry, in the automotive industry, said about Ford?
You're crazy.
You're crazy. Absolutely. Wouldn't you guys love it if your employer came to you and doubled your salary and shortened your workday? Yeah? You would think they're the greatest person in the world, right? But if you had to pay that, that's kind of a hard pill to swallow, right? You're used to paying these guys. You're used to going through this. So this was truly radical for the time, and everybody thought he was crazy. but the results are unmistakable. In the 2 years that preceded after Ford did this sort of revolution, their net profit increased from $30 million to $60 million. They maintained a 13,000 FTE workforce, and they produced 260,000 cars. The rest of the auto industry needed 66,000 employees to produce 286,000 cars. With a fourth of the workforce, they were producing as many cars as the rest of the industry was combined, all because of this revolution. And it was all predicated, and yes, we won't get into the issues of, you know, paying people well tends to keep them around, but reducing their workforce, this is what I was really interested, or work the work week, this is what I was sort of interested in. And so what Ford found is, if you push people, or if you start them at 40 hours a week, they can maintain a steady level of productivity. You can push people to a higher level of productivity, and you will get a bump in productivity for a few weeks. And then with that same level of effort, still plugging away at 60 hours a week, their overall productivity declines. And this happens in weeks. This isn't like this occurs in months. The productivity decline happens within weeks. So Ford really did kind of stumble on that, hey, this 40-hour sort of thing is kind of a magical number. So because we don't like to use manufacturing industries to represent software, right, because developing software and testing software is an inherently creative process, right, we do have some analogies and we have some studies. So Clinton Keith, who's a CTO of High Moon Studio, which is a gaming studio, following agile processes, they had their own internal study, and they presented this at a conference, and they found that if they did 40 hours a week, and they could maintain a certain level of velocity of getting work done. But when they forced their folks into overtime, they did get a bump. They were producing more stories during that period of time. But it was only a matter of weeks before that productivity declined. So it's not just the manufacturing industry which this magical 40-hour-a-week sort of thing applies. It's also the IT industry. And so that's something that we should really take to heart, especially if we're managers of people or, you know, we're working a lot of overtime. There's a lot of studies out there that support that forcing people to work overtime for just a matter of weeks will cause an overall productivity decline. And that's something that you can take back and address with folks. So this is the basis of the 90-30-4-5 rule, which you can now imagine is 90 minutes of intense thinking followed by 30 minutes of kind of less taxing mental activity. Doing that four times a day, that's your 8-hour day. Doing that 5 days a week, that's your 40-hour week. So it all fits rather nicely, which is why I coined the term 90-30-4-5. Does anybody find that useful? Some? Not so much. People are like, I don't have that kind of control over my work, right? So the long and the short of it is if you force people into a crunch, you force them over, that productivity is going to end. Their productivity is going to decline. And it usually takes longer to recover the productivity than the bump that you get in productivity for a short period of time. So just remember that if you're a manager in your team and they're asking for a lot of overtime, this is going to happen, right? And this might be a great opportunity to start talking about, you know, additional staff to accomplish or changes in the way things are structured so that your projects can accommodate a more reasonable sort of work schedule. So keep that in mind. If you can't control the 40-hour portion, right, at least try and control the 90-30 portion, because that'll also help you if you go all the way back to the context switching. If you're just focusing on one thing for a 2-hour block, right, and then focusing on something else, you'll minimize the productivity hit. All right, just what I said. 90 minutes of work, 30 minutes of less taxing work. There were other studies, I do want to point this out, there were other studies that focused on alternate ways of doing overtime, such as working overtime 1 week and then not the next, and then working overtime the following week. And what they found is there was effectively no change in the productivity hit, right? Doing overtime every other week just meant it took 6 weeks to reach that point of declining productivity as opposed to 3. So you just can't avoid the productivity hit when you force people to burn more than 40 hours a week at work. All right, silence. How many people have experienced silence in a conversation? Was that with your spouse or at work?
Yes,
right? Somebody said yes. Have you guys ever invoked somebody's silence? Or were you the silent one?
Yes.
So how many people have evoked silence in somebody else? How many have been silent when somebody has said something to them? More people? Very good. So I did have a kind of a corny example, but, you know, I won't insult you guys. But when you're talking to somebody and they're silent after you say something, what's your first reaction? Let's see some hands. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Like I'm doing to you right now. I'll let you off the hook. He's absolutely right. In fact, I have seen people who are trying to make a passionate point when I've been silent. They've undid their own point in trying to convince me of their point simply by being silent. Anybody else? Disagreement? Absolutely. Anyone else? Lots of different. Good. Not understanding or rejecting their idea. You have. So there's lots of different reasons, right? I don't agree with you is one interpretation. I'm lost. I'm mad. I'm not listening. I'm waiting to act, right? I can't put my thoughts into words. How many people are in here are self-described introverts? This probably really applies to you, right? You like to think things over before you say anything. You tend to probably be more silent in conversations than other folks. I'm thinking, right, is another one for introverts. What's interesting is that little awkward pause in a conversation can have so many different meanings. And oftentimes, we don't actually know what it means, right? Unless we're the one being silent, then we know exactly what it means, right? Or it's from our spouse, then it's number one, right? So silence is very, very powerful. It's a very powerful communication tool. And when you're in the middle of a passionate sort of conversation, that's one of the best times to leverage silence. But there's a way to do it. Most of the time when we encounter silence, it's a natural thing that occurs, right? And there is some hidden intent in here. One of the reasons that we are silent is because we don't want to reveal our intent. We don't want to tell people that we're mad, right? Because we don't want to make things worse, or we don't want to tell them that we're thinking because we don't want to appear dumb, or, you know, if you're lost, you don't want to admit that either you weren't paying attention or you're truly confused, right? We don't like to reveal our intentions here because usually it's some sort of judgment that comes back on us. So we just use the silence and let it be. And we let it sit there like a bomb, right? William Shatner is great at what they call the pregnant pause, right? It's not the same thing. So you can leverage silence in conversation if you start thinking about, you know what, I can convey something separate without having to say any words. And so you can do that. And so one of the things to remember is if silence is being done intentionally, right, as opposed to one of those unintentional things, understand that you need it to be natural. If I just started saying something and then I was just dead silent, you guys would be like, what the hell? What you're doing makes no sense whatsoever, right? So remember that. You need to be natural with the way you leverage it. And I'm speeding this up a little bit because I'm running a little long on time. It does give yourself a chance to think, and you should always cherish that, right? Just because somebody says something doesn't mean you need to rebut it. Sometimes you can just be silent and think about it, right? Even if you disagree with it. There's always time to have conversation later. You can also use silence to give the other person time to think. This is where I think you're wrong. Rethink your point. I'm going to give you some time to do it. Right? So you can do that too. Understand that silence has many meanings. So if you encounter silence, don't automatically assume that you know what that silence means. Right? You might need to ask some clarifying questions to figure out, are you lost? Are you mad? Do you disagree? Are you thinking of something else? Do you need more time to think? Right? Ask those keywords. And if you're an introvert who accidentally drops silence into a conversation, feel free to say, you know what, I'm thinking about what you said. Or I'm trying to process it and understand it. Right? It's okay to say that, but it it lets the other person know what the silence means to you, and that's important in a conversation. So don't forget that as well. And then finally, if you are going to be silent in a conversation, you need to realize that you are responsible for communicating the meaning of that silence. So if somebody's having a passionate conversation and you know it's a disagreeing point and you're silent, and you feel and you know why you're silent but you don't tell them, and they walk away thinking that you're mad at them, and they go around telling somebody else, that's really on you. Because silence in and of itself doesn't communicate a meaning. It lets people assume a meaning. That's really what silence does. So be careful of that. All right, so we got a few minutes, a couple minutes left. So let's talk about encouragement in the workplace. How many people have heard, you know, one rotten apple spoils the bunch? That old adage. Well, there's a really interesting video done by Brain Games. I forget who it is. Anyway, there's a guy who does, it's not Mike Rowe, it's another guy who does some of those discovery type channels and does voiceovers and narration. But they have these guys, they have people there sitting there with a little kid's toy that has the shapes that you put in, you push it down, you turn a timer, try and put the shapes in before it all pops up. And in one section of the video, he's got the guy standing over their back, you know, telling them, you know, you're doing great, you've got plenty of time, things are going really well for you. And then that section of the video, he's like, oh, you're never going to get it. That was totally the wrong move. Right? So what was interesting about that, and we'll run through some slides if we have some seconds here to kind of illustrate this point, but what was really interesting about that is the folks who received the positive encouragement did far better than the folks who had the negative encouragement. So even though conceivably the person standing behind you really has no bearing on the task that you're doing and you're focused on that task, simply the presence of that sort of negative vibe in the environment can really affect your productivity. So if you have somebody who, what I call B and C, which is bitching and complaining in the work environment, they can really bring down the productivity of the rest of the team. Even if their complaints have merit, that type of behavior can bring down the productivity of people around them. So that's something to keep in mind. And so here's some things that you can do. There'll be a slide will come up. I want you to read the slide, look at the lady's face, and at the bottom it'll tell you something to do, and I want you to try and do that before the timer runs out. You'll have plenty of time to do this. But hopefully you'll see how this pans out. This may be hard in such a large group, but we'll do it. Not too hard, right? Pretty funny. This is from Brain Games. I stole it, so I gave them credit down there. I don't want to get in trouble. All right, here's another one. All right, anybody know how many vowels there are? Still counting? 27? I counted 26, not including Y. That was not intended to be a trick, guys. All right, so here's another one. All right, that's pretty easy, right? All right, so here's the next one. I think the answer is 18. So let me ask you, the first two sets of slides, did those tasks inherently feel more difficult than the last two? Did anybody experience that? Some people? Everyone else says, that's too cheesy for me to buy into. That's okay. So there's lots of videos that you can see on this and lots of research that you can do. But simply, the words, facial expressions, body language, it's not just somebody who's actually vocalizing, you know, kind of the bitching and complaining, just the general attitude can bring down the productivity of your team. So keep that in mind. And if you're one of those people, right, and I'll be honest, I used to be a really super arrogant, condescending pain in the butt. That used to be me until I grew up. You can change, and you can actually have a positive effect on people around you. That phrase, fake it till you make it, if you will, right? If you're a manager and you've got some people, you know, ask people to put on that happy face, right? Don't let people bring down the productivity of your team. Don't let other people do that. Use lots of positive encouragement. And I don't mean the cheesy affirmation, you know.
Good job.
Right? We're not talking that, right? We are talking about a general positive vibe and keeping the negativity out in order to keep us from affecting productivity. All right, so running through this. A lot of this is based on research by Daniel Kahneman. There's also a couple of other books that are probably a little easier to read that have some similar stuff. You Are Not So Smart, You Are Less Dumb. They have a lot of different things about cognitive biases, which are a lot of fun. But things to take away, when you want to change somebody's mind, right, first thing in the morning, first thing, you know, after lunch, you have about a 90-minute window. If you want to be creative, depending if you're a night owl or kind of a morning lark or day lark, right, 6 to 7 in the evening, maybe 1 or 2 in the morning, you have to figure out that time for yourself. Scheduling meetings between 2 and 4 in the afternoon on Tuesdays, yes, thank you, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, unless you're doing silent by consent, right, then you could do Monday and Friday. Adopt the 90-30-4-5 rule when you can. It'll help your productivity. It'll help your entire team, right? Block off some time. Focus no more than 90 minutes. This is why in session-based test management, they talk about don't do a session for longer than 90 minutes. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but this falls right in line with that, right? That intense critical thinking, you need some time to recover afterwards. Limit your work week. Leverage silence in conversations. Understand it has many meanings. Use that power carefully. And then finally, don't discourage in your work environment. Have some positive encouragement. And thank you, everybody. Any questions?
Thank you for listening to this episode of STP Radio. Join our mailing list and learn more about STP and future STPCon events at softwaretestprofessionals.com.